Blog Talk Radio.
That is my cue, live from San Diego, California. Welcome, everyone, to This Week in Oncology. I'm your co-host and producer of the show, Greg Masters. And joining me, as always, is my partner and inspiration for the series, Dr. Richard Just. We are broadcasting on Wednesday, August the 8th, 2012, and we're having a heat wave here in San Diego. It's about 78 degrees. And on the show today, we're delighted to visit with Dr. Pushpendu Banerjee, a medical oncologist and hematologist practicing in La Jolla, California. And for more information, click on the bio that we have on the Blog Talk Radio chat box. Dr. Banerjee is a diplomat on the American Board of Internal Medicine and Medical Oncology and a partner at CCARE, which is California Cancer Associates for Research and Education. He's active on the medical staff of Scripps La Jolla Memorial Hospital in La Jolla, California. Dr. Banerjee completed his medical degree in New Delhi, India, and moved to the United States in 1992. He received a master's degree in public health at UNC Chapel Hill, where he focused on health education and cancer prevention. Dr. Banerjee completed an internal medicine internship and residency at the Southern Illinois University School of Medicine in 1997. He continued there as an assistant professor in internal medicine, winning awards for teaching excellence and contributed to the medical informatics research. He moved to the Scripps Clinic in La Jolla as part of the teaching faculty and was recognized for making outstanding contributions to medical education by the trainees. A fellowship in medical oncology at the Scripps Clinic and Research Foundation followed, and Dr. Banerjee is board certified in internal medicine and medical oncology. His special interests include GI malignancies, cancers of the nervous system, with an emphasis on the management of the elderly with cancers. Dr. Banerjee participates in clinical trials sponsored by Scripps and UCLA and is a member of the Society of Hematology and American Society of Clinical Oncology. So with that, welcome, Dr. Banerjee, and Rich, over to you.
Thanks, Greg, and welcome, Dr. Banerjee.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. That was a pretty impressive bio. Are you sure it's mine? I didn't realize.
Yeah, it's yours. I should mention to the audience who may not know that Dr. Banerjee and I are partners in CCARE. And it's been my pleasure to work with him. Unfortunately, I don't get a chance to interact with him as often as I'd like to because he's in La Jolla and I'm in Escondido, and it's like a different world.
On my part, Dr. Just, you've been one of our mentors in our group and have mentored some of the younger people who joined in and have provided direction and guidance in terms of how best to, you know, not only practice oncology in the best possible way, but also to live your life and have been a role model for all of us. So we thank you.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. I appreciate that. That's very nice of you to say. Well, I thought we'd start out by mentioning or going along your special interest, which is gastrointestinal tract malignancies. Please be open to shifting to whatever subject you want to.
Sure.
The main interest, as I understand it, is with colon cancer. But I was just wondering if we could start off with the recent ASCO meetings and
right.
if there was anything that caught your eye as far as each one of the gastrointestinal tract malignancies, anything special under each of these headings that might change your practice pattern may change how you practice oncology.
Sure. And for you know, my interest in gastroenterology, you know, it kind of developed over time. And I think, you know, the background of it is that I'm supported by this excellent cancer center at Scripps, and I have access to some of the best surgeons, including specialized people who just do colorectal surgery. And so we do see a lot of referrals and second opinions and have the opportunity to manage a whole bunch of patients over, you know, the last several years that I worked here. And also we have the opportunity of having hepatologists and other people who have special interests in liver cancer and also deal with some of the other benign gastrointestinal conditions that have a higher propensity of developing cancer in future, and such as hepatitis B or hepatitis C or Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. But to Dr. Just, you know, in terms of the ASCO, you know, there have been a lot of there has been a lot of new information about several new drugs. In fact, we probably have two or three new drugs that either have just been approved or in the pipeline and have finished their phase 3 trials or phase 2 trials and moving on to phase 3 that look very encouraging. And let me go through, you know, I'll go through some random, I haven't, you know, prepared for this, but for you know, when we talk about GI malignancy as a whole, you know, colorectal cancer, you know, dividing colon and rectum separately, obviously the management differs there, and I can explain a little bit more later, is important. But then we talk about esophageal cancer, we talk about gastric cancer, liver cancer being separate, and then we do see some small bowel cancer, which tends to be a very different and a very aggressive disease. But a couple of things that happened in this ASCO was presentation on something called the CORRECT study, C-O-R-R-E-C-T, and it's with a drug which is called regorafenib, and I can't say most of these names, but it's one of the newer drugs. And I think it was used in a situation where, you know, people had failed two or three different lines of chemotherapy, and they showed improvement in progression-free survival. And it's one of those medicines that have been used for liver cancer. It's kind of similar in that in its mechanistic way it works. And then there was the other drug that showed very good data in a phase 3 trial. Called eflibercept. Again, you know, the pronunciation is a little off, but that's kind of the name of the drug. And Dr. Just was reminding me that we had participated in the clinical trials of this drug. And, you know, it's interesting. It's a fusion protein that was used for treatment of wet macular degeneration in the eye because it works like Avastin. And it was co-developed by Sanofi and Aventis, and it inhibits the vascular, the endothelial growth factors that make cancer grow. And it's kind of a specific kind of drug that inhibits both the vascular epithelial growth factor A and B, and it works as what is called as a wedge of trap. So I think the study was called VITAL, and they have names for all these, and it was mostly for second-line treatment of locally advanced or metastatic cancer, and in the phase 3 study, it showed that it improved overall survival. So
right.
That I think is going to be game-changing. And then some of the other things that happened with other GI malignancies was there was a study that used something called irinotecan with platinum in gastroesophageal cancer in second line that showed improvement in disease-free survival. Let's see what else I remember. There was something in liver cancer where they used sorafenib, which is the standard of care, along with a procedure called arterial chemoembolization, or TACE, with drug-eluting doxorubicin, and that was better than using sorafenib alone. The other thing that I was watching with interest is that there's this medicine called Everolimus or Afinitor, which originally was indicated for kidney cancer, but you know, last year we found out that it modifies hormone receptors, and even in a situation where breast cancer had become resistant to the hormone treatments, which are usually pretty benign, you could add Everolimus to this drug, and the hormones would work again. And I think the presentation was under a label that study was called a Bolero trial, but there's something called a Radiant study, which showed that if you use sandostatin in neuroendocrine tumors along with everolimus, that tends to work better and has a slightly higher disease-free survival than using the sandostatin alone. And neuroendocrine tumors are kind of interesting, slow-growing tumors, but cause a lot of morbidity because, you know, they can cause bowel blockages and basically make you miserable, but they're slow-growing, so people live for a long period of time. So it's very important to keep these tumors under control and not have them grow. And this combination of using sandostatin and everolimus looks promising. And whether it's going to be game-changing or not, I'm not sure yet.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot more, a lot of other presentations too, and you know, and I think two or three new drugs will get approved because of those presentations for metastatic colon.
Well, that's a nice overview. And in the days of Steve Jobs, who had a slower growing neuroendocrine type of tumor. There's been a lot more interest in dealing with those types of tumors. And so I'm glad that you brought that up as one area where we are addressing. For many years, for those types of tumors, there was really nothing. So it's interesting that some of the newer agents are being tested. And we had a drug representative in the office yesterday who was saying that his drug, which is specific for a certain type of hematologic malignancy, is being tested in pancreatic cancer.
Wow.
And I was, you know, and we haven't mentioned pancreatic cancer because that's one of the most awful cancers that we have to treat. So it would seem predictable that we'd try anything new, you know, to see if there's any activity. And to my surprise, the company was actually testing it or at least considering testing it either alone or in combination with other drugs.
Sure.
So that was quite interesting.
Right.
Do you see pancreatic cancer?
I'm not sure how much how you know. One of the game-changing things that happened last year was in the situation where the cancer cannot be cut out and it's unresectable. Our standards of care was using this medicine called gemcitabine, and then sometimes people threw in a pill called Tarceva, and that did improve the overall outcomes. But then last year, there was a publication in NEJM and where they combined a whole bunch of azathioprine drugs, which are used for colon cancer, where for the first time in many, many years, they were able to show improvement over what was standard of care. And that regimen is called FOLFIRINOX, where they use something called oxaliplatin, irinotecan, and then they also use 5-FU, which tends to be a backbone. It's a tough treatment, but I don't know how much you've used it, Dr. Just, but I have, for especially my young patients, I have used FOLFIRINOX, and some of them have had complete responses, and sometimes I've had people who were initially unresectable who have gone on and had surgery because we've been able to downstage the tumor so much. It's to be seen if this strategy would improve the overall outcomes in the long term. But I have people who had presented where they were told that there was not much to do for them, who were not only downstaged, had their VPL and are disease-free and alive, and hopefully will remain alive and disease-free for a few more years. And that has been a game-changing scenario.
Right. Yeah, I can think of one patient right off the bat that I've treated recently with FOLFIRINOX. And she's a little bit older than very young, let's say, and had a total resection, we thought, of the primary tumor 3 years ago. And just because the surgeon was not 100% certain he had gotten everything, we put her on gemcitabine, which she tolerated quite well. It was sort of like an adjuvant treatment. and she did well for 3 years, but recently had a recurrence, which was in a site that was localized to the peripancreatic area, mm-hmm. but was deemed to be unresectable. So I treated her with FOLFIRINOX, and she really got sick. I mean,
it's a tough regimen.
And the worst part of it was the stomatitis or mucositis, mm-hmm. And she had a prolonged lowering of her blood counts. So now we've just finished a course of 5-FU and radiation therapy, mm-hmm. and the goal is exactly like you mentioned, to try to convert her to an operable situation where we can get her some more good time. I'm glad you mentioned that program, because it really can be a barn burner. But, if the patients can tolerate it, the results have been surprisingly terrific. But that, with pancreatic cancer, that has always been an interest with me. But and when we've tried to put patients on protocols, I don't know if this has been your experience, but when I have the patients, we don't have a protocol.
Right.
When I don't have the patients, right.
Sure.
So anything else?
Right, so that we were mostly talking about therapeutics, and you know what, one of the things I wish I had more time I could devote to was, as we learn to take care of patients with cancer, I think I'm starting to realize that everybody's cancer is different. Even everybody's colon cancer is different, and they behave differently. And if there were ways to prognosticate in terms of, you know, how they're going to do, especially for early stage disease, and better identify those patients who would benefit from the therapy up front versus people who would do okay with observation, that's kind of, mm-hmm. I think, our next step. And I think, you know, this ASCO, there was, more presentations about a study that looks at the genetics of the colon cancer, just like we do in breast cancer, using something called an oncotype, but this time they were looking at oncotype testing in colon cancer, especially stage 2 cancer, which means that the cancer has not spread to the lymph nodes. And for most of these patients, we normally do not recommend chemotherapy because it's never shown to be of any benefit in terms of changing overall survival. But there's a gene assay now, which is a 12-gene assay on these stage 2. It is not; it's predictive of how they're going to do, but we still don't know the answer whether giving them chemotherapy would change that outcome. So I think we're waiting for the additional data to come as to how to use this assay. But at least we can now prognosticate and say, well, some people have higher-risk colon cancers even at a stage 2, and have a higher likelihood that something may potentially happen to them, but mm-hmm. we don't know how to deal with them yet. And in the same line, I think this whole concept of microsatellite instability that predicts, response to adjuvant therapy, there were additional papers in ASCO, and actually the GI conference symposium that happened just before that, there were some presentations mm-hmm. in there about that. So that's kind of a different part of the predictive part of, you know, GI oncology.
Right. Well, I think that's where a great deal of interest is going in oncology, because a lot of, like you mentioned, a lot of these clinical trials that were previously thought to be negative as far as the effects were including people who were not going to respond anyway, because they didn't have the genetic makeup.
Correct.
And so that skewed our results toward the drug not being effective. So this is a very important area in oncology that's just starting to gain its momentum.
Right.
And we had Dr. Topol on, speaking of individualized oncology, mm-hmm. A couple of weeks ago, and we touched on that issue quite a bit. And I really think that's where the area is going, but it's still in the early phases, as you mentioned. And we have high expectations for it, and I know patients have high expectations for it, but it's important for them to realize that a lot of these things still have to be studied.
Sure.
Now, also, well, we've been talking about medicine, and specifically GI cancers for the most part, but you also have another job, and that is you know where I'm going with this.
Well, you know, I wouldn't call it as much of a job, but I'm because of the campus that I work on at the Scripps Memorial, I've been, most of the practicing physicians on this campus belong to a larger group of doctors, which is called the Scripps ZyMed or ZyMed doctors. And at some point, several years ago, we felt an acute lack of, specialized doctors who are available in the campus to manage acute illnesses. There are emergency room physicians and there are intensive care doctors, but there is the in-between where patients are sick, not sick enough to be in the ICU, and once they get admitted, usually practicing physicians like me and Dr. Just, we would not have the time to manage those patients. And, you would go in the morning and try to hustle and try to figure out what they would need and then come at the end of the day after our clinics are over. So there's this acute need of what is called a hospitalist, which is a sort of a new breed of physicians who practice, who are well, super specialized internal medicine doctors who just practice hospital medicine. And I did set up a program, and I still oversee it. So I that's why it's not a job anymore. It's more like, okay, when the program needs any tweaks or it needs modification and things like that, I still have input in that, and I spend a lot of time doing that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the other hat
but
I wear.
You do get some satisfaction from it, I'm sure.
I do, absolutely. And so I'm part of the ZyMed board, and we meet once a month, and we strategize in terms of how we can improve patient care on the campus and, coordinate with everybody else. So that is a very satisfying part of, medicine that I am involved in. And, it also keeps me abreast of the changes in healthcare that are coming, and in oncology it is going to be very important in terms of how we manage our patients, in terms of how the organizations are going to compensate us for providing better care and how do we demonstrate better care. So
right.
those are important questions that we need to answer.
Right. Right. Well, and you've also taken over the financial piece of C-care.
Yeah, one more thing, right?
One more thing that you do. So it's no wonder that I've spent about 6 months trying to get you on the show. more than that, actually.
That's true.
Greg actually estimated that our first contact, our first mention of the possibility, was in November of last year. Each time,
I apologize for that.
It's tough. You don't have to apologize. Knowing what you're doing.
But, what ends up happening is that over lunch, all the meetings, everything else I do, I spend the lunch hour doing the other stuff that I'm responsible for. And so, obviously, the clinical part of what I do is very hectic, but then in the morning I spend a couple of hours doing some of the administrative stuff, and then over lunch, most of my lunch are booked out because I'm the good part of this is if I'm stuck in a meeting or doing something else, then I don't eat and I'm trying to lose weight, if we done successfully.
I understand. it's a recurring problem with all of us, I'll tell you that. getting back to the let me interrupt for a second and see, Greg, is there anything that you would like to ask Dr. Banerjee?
Well, I can't resist, but given the group focus and the explanation around the emergence of hospitalists, whether he would throw a thought or two out there on ACOs in general and perhaps in terms of oncology.
Okay.
Well, I think I think we need to wait to sort of define that better. I mean, there are various definitions of ACO, and I think specifically for oncology, accountable care organizations, which is all about, you know, demonstrating good quality and cost-effective medicine, we need to define how oncologists would approach their patients, and then the insurance companies or the ACOs reimburse the physicians for and in what model would they reimburse the physicians? Because at the end of the day, when it's sort of a per episode situation, it becomes the incentives are different between the physicians, the hospitals, the patients, and the acute care facilities. And I think the ACOs, because it takes over the financial responsibility and then divvies out the compensation based on where it's needed most and based on outcomes, I think in the longer run it has a potential to improve healthcare and reduce the cost of care. But there are just too many people with too many different incentives that need to be aligned, and I think before it falls into place, the alignment and how the resources would be allocated needs to fall into place. Otherwise, you know, it'd be difficult.
It's a unique perspective, the hospitalist perspective as well.
Right.
Particularly in terms of efficiency and more better workflow internally in the hospital, minimally better workflow internally in the hospital. Yeah.
Right. But, you know, I think globally, I think we have to look at the stakeholders, and between the providers, the payers, and the patients, all of our eventual intent is the same. So from that perspective, if we align our objectives together and then figure out what is a fair way to make sure that the shareholders are not hurting in any fashion, I think once that piece comes into place, then I think we would see a very healthy and a robust way of, ACO sort of defining how we need to do things.
Well, I would love to explore that question, because I don't know if you're aware, but in Florida, one of the U.S. Oncology affiliates has partnered with a local hospital system, and I believe it's Florida Blue, to actually do an oncology ACO, a commercial market oncology ACO, which would be very interesting to explore.
Sure. And even our group, and, you know, C-Care is becoming a larger group, and as we grow, there's been a lot of interest from the healthcare, the payer industry over here, and we've been partnering with MOASC to see if, we could grow to a point where for certain areas we could be a plug-in for ACO and then use electronic medical records to, you know, make sure that our workflow is, I mean, it does take more time, but it gets smoothened out, and then we can demonstrate high-quality care with a cost-effective perspective. It's going to happen.
Right. Well, you brought up one of my favorite subjects, electronic medical records. I just finished a blog on that, and people feel free to read what my opinions are. But I think you're right. That, you know, we can't live with them, and we can't live without them.
Therefore, yesterday I walked into one of my gastroenterologist's office, and he said, before the EHR, I used to see 25 to 30 patients a day, and now I can only see 15 because I can't keep up.
Right. So much for efficiency.
Well, I think we're running out of time, and Dr. Banerjee, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your coming on today, and you've enlightened us on gastrointestinal tract cancers, the current status of that, of where we are, and some newer issues, and about the business of medicine, which is also we're all getting involved with. more frequently.
So let me echo the sentiment and thank Dr. Banerjee. We do this weekly on This Week in Oncology. And join us next week for Dr. James Mason from Scripps Health. Thanks for joining, everyone. Talk to you later. Bye now.
It's my pleasure.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Let me in. Shattered windows in the sand.